Greetings, greetings, once again, to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. It's the fastest streaming show on the internet. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and it's good to be back. We had to do a special Saturday edition of the podcast because we may be completely buried in snow by Sunday, and we'll be digging out, and we won't have time for any of this. Welcome. Welcome. It's good to have you back. And we're good to be back. We wanted to come on last week, but we were unable to due to our internet service provider and their recent efforts to upgrade the internet grid out here to 1997 technology. That's right. They're laying fiber optics out here to the farm. I remember when I got a job downtown Denver working for Bob Enyart Live, 1997. And the phone company was storing these huge wheels of fiber optic cable in the parking lot there. And they were putting fiber optics in downtown Denver circa 1997. Here we are. We're about to get it out here, so they say. But last week, well, it was just a catastrophic failure of bandwidth is what it was. And we apologize for all that, but we're hoping that will resolve itself. Well, it won't resolve itself, but at least it's been resolved for this week. So where do we want to start this week? You want to start at the White House? You want to start at Fox News? You want to start with my review of Donald Trump's first 100 days? I'll give you a quick review. Donald Trump's first 71 years. Not impressed. How about that? Yes, he built some buildings. Yes, he made lots of money. But what good is it if a man would gain the whole world but lose his very soul? And so that's where I judge Donald Trump to be. I wish him the best. I hope he succeeds. All of that. First 100 days. All right. Let's start at the White House, though, because I could not resist when I saw the picture of one of the stupidest politicians in the history of American politics, Sarah Palin, at the White House, standing in front of Hillary Clinton's, what do you call it there? Portrait? Hillary's portrait, where the artist desperately tried to capture her humanity and failed. But there's the portrait hanging in the White House. And I've got the story here from the Washington Examiner, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. I said, reunited with President Trump at the White House last Wednesday, Ted Nugent and Kid Rock were also present, and the conservatives went wild. Wild, I say, yes, yes. And so this is a barometer of what has happened to conservatism here in America, really since Barack Obama. Barack Obama was so flagrantly far left that he made people like Ted Nugent and Kid Rock appear to be conservative. Yes, so-called conservatism has now devolved to the point where the masses of ignorant, unwashed so-called conservatives now look up to dim-witted rock star Ted Nugent, vulgar, as far as I can tell, a pagan. Nugent, whatever. And one of the four horsemen of the cultural apocalypse from the early 90s, Kid Rock. Please. Anyone who helped white kids listen to rap, that was a sign of the end right there. So you got those two bozos and the hapless moron mom, Sarah, who gave her children over to the public schools and on a good day can barely string a coherent paragraph together. And when she does, it's to give credibility to the likes of, well, people like Ted Nugent and Kid Rock. And there they were, getting their picture taken in front of Hillary Clinton. And that's conservatism. You got Kid Rock. You got Ted Nugent. You got Sarah Palin at the leading edge of the phalanx of conservatism. And in walks a liberal Democrat strip club operator from Queens. And folks, the rest is history. Can we say that's it? There you go. All right. Hey, I'm sorry. I've seen her in interviews. She's not that bright, okay? That's all. All right. Now, you'll remember this story if you've listened to The Worldview for any length of time. The sad story from Roseville, Michigan, of Taylor Truppiano, the 24-year-old man. He lives about 20 miles north of Detroit in the frozen tundra of northern Michigan. You remember that he was warming up his car in his driveway back on January 5th when he ran inside for about 10 minutes to get his girlfriend and his 2-year-old son and to allow his car to warm up like a civilized human being. Well, little did he know, he was in violation of state law when he went in to get his girlfriend and the daughter, and the car was warming up, and he was issued a citation. Got a ticket for $128 for leaving his car running, violating a law intended to hamper car theft. A law intended to hamper car theft. What about the law against car theft? Does that not hamper car theft? Well, apparently it doesn't anymore. Well, the city attorney up there, he says that, listen, this Truppiano fellow, he left his car wide open right there, running right there. As if Mr. Truppiano was some sort of mad criminal. Truppiano says that he thinks people should be allowed to warm up their cars in their own driveways. And the city attorney said, what do you think? You live in a free country? Get out of here with that. Anyway, Truppiano put his ticket up on Facebook. And his sad story has been shared thousands and thousands and thousands of times. He's got another hearing coming up in May. The saga continues. Now, according to Roseville District Court, someone unrelated to the case has offered to pay the $128 fine for Mr. Truppiano and end the saga altogether. But the court has not decided whether or not to accept the payment from the unrelated party offering to pay, because they want to make a point, apparently. Mr. Truppiano has made it, he's publicly made it known that the governing officials in Michigan are an utter gross failure, in that the fact that they have a law against stealing cars is not enough to deter people from stealing cars. Now they have to have a law saying civilized people can't warm up their cars, and then the civilized people end up going to court. Well, the next time they catch a car thief there in northern Michigan, they should put him on television and cane all the skin off his backside. And then the law against stealing cars would once again deter people from stealing cars. And civilized Americans like Taylor Truppiano could warm up his car in his own driveway. And we could live in a free country again. We will keep tabs on the story. No, it wasn't. I didn't offer to pay the guy's fine. Although I think it's a fine idea. Should we start a GoFundMe page? Yeah. Everybody starts a GoFundMe page for everything anymore. Every time I see a story on the local news, they started a GoFundMe page. And so maybe we should start a GoFundMe page. Let's go to Fox News. What will this past week be remembered as? It will be the week that the world found out that they could live without Bill O'Reilly. And Fox News found out, too. And it's not so much about the sexual harassment, the lawsuits, and the money. Fox has plenty of money. And sexual harassment doesn't bother the executives at Fox all that much. What it really comes down to, I think, is money. I think the junior, what are the boys' names there at Fox? The Australian fellow who owns the network, Murdoch. The junior Murdoch boys, starting to look at the bottom line, After they sent Megyn Kelly packing, I can hear them at the board meeting. They're like, Father, Father Covey, this Megyn Kelly, you were paying her $10 million a year. $10 million, Dad. Are you out of your mind? We replaced her with a chuckling moron in a bad tie. Ratings are the same, Dad. I think you're off your game. We've got to get rid of O'Reilly. Why are we paying O'Reilly $25 million a year, Dad? Please. Replace him with a fence post. Ratings the same, Dad. Packing you off to a home. And off goes Rupert Murdoch into the... Now, conservatives on the radio say that this is all a liberal conspiracy to liberalify Fox News, is what they say is going on. They've gotten rid of the stalwart conservative, Bill O'Reilly, after getting rid of the stalwart Republican conservative stripper, Megyn Kelly. And so it's all an effort to make Fox News liberal, is what's going on. So I think it's more about the money. And, well, I think I've been proven right already. Because the chuckling moron bozo in a bad tie interviews a tranny freak of nature and wins the night on his very first night. A barometer of Western civilization right there, as a matter of fact. Now, let us go from Fox News to Planned Parenthood. Yeah, I said Planned Parenthood. A story from PBS is reporting on a new musical project called 7 Inches for Planned Parenthood. And it's where famous musicians are releasing vinyl records with music dedicated to Planned Parenthood and child killing. And they're raising money, apparently. Let's see here. You got famous people, he said to his extremely attractive audio engineer. Sharon Van Etten. Ah. I'm going to have to throw all her records out. St. Vincent. Have you heard of St. Vincent? I have not. Slater Kinney. That's one of the famous musicians making a record for Planned Parenthood. Comedian Pete Holmes and comedian Zach Galifianakis. I'm just not familiar with these people. Mary J. Blige. Seems like I heard of her in the 80s. Maybe. Foo Fighters. I heard of the Foo Fighters. They're a bunch of pro-aborts. I have to throw all their records out. Oddly enough, we don't have any of these people's records, and I don't even know what a Galifianakis is. But these people are disgusting. Even their record, 7 Inches for Planned Parenthood, has to be a double entendre. They're just a bunch of sex-obsessed perverts. And the reason they want to raise money for Planned Parenthood is because they've all utilized the services somewhere along the way. Yeah. I know it's a bold accusation to make, but keep in mind, about a third of all Americans have utilized abortion services. And another third or more have participated actively. So that's more than half the people. The most diabolical criminal conspiracy in the history of mankind has taken place over the last 50 years. Where 60-plus million people have been murdered, and virtually the entire nation is culpable. Almost every person in the country is culpable at some level. So that's the devil's dream, not just to pull off the greatest criminal, diabolical crime in history, but to get everybody involved. That's what he likes to do. And so the famous musicians, well, I shouldn't say, they're not famous. They're not that famous. I never heard of them. But meanwhile, here's an update on something I've been saying for over 10 years. I've been saying for over 10 years that if there was a respect for life in this country, doctors would have already developed an artificial womb so that premature babies, even tubal pregnancies, could be brought to term and end in something resembling birth and a live human person coming out there at the end. Well, I have a report here from The Independent in London. Extremely premature babies could be kept alive in the future using an artificial womb that scientists plan to test in humans after they've completed a successful study involving unborn lambs. Ironically enough. Yes, this artificial womb allowed fetal lambs to develop to an age equivalent to 23 weeks in humans. And the Independent goes on to tell us that human infants born at 23 weeks have just a 15% chance of survival. This raises to more than 50% at 24 weeks, and babies born at 25 weeks have an 80% chance of survival. I found that pretty astonishing, that in that swing of 3 weeks, survival goes from 15 to 80%. That's pretty amazing. Well, this new invention closely replicates conditions in a real womb. That's according to scientists at the Center for Fetal Research at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Inside the device, the infant's own heart circulates blood through the umbilical cord into an external gas exchange machine, taking the place of the mother's placenta, while synthetic amniotic fluid enriched with nutrients flows in and out of the temperature-controlled, near-sterile artificial womb. They say it could be ready for human trials in 3 to 5 years. Some people are terrified of this science fiction-like technology. They say it could mean the end of conventional pregnancy. I wouldn't worry too much about that, for crying out loud. Now, listen to this. I found this interesting. Scientists at the University of Cambridge have grown a miniature womb lining in a lab, which they hope can provide new insights into the early stages of pregnancy when the placenta is established. Why are they developing a womb lining, you might ask? Well, because the lining is extremely important in a successful pregnancy, because the fetus has to implant in the lining. And if the environment in the uterus isn't just right, the fetus can't implant and the baby is spontaneously aborted. And just so you people know, the oral contraceptive, known as popularly as the birth control pill, is specifically designed to prevent development of a normal lining in the uterus. I'm just saying, that's all. Okay, just so you know. And here's some scientific evidence that that's very important, that lining. And the pill. Well, the pill. You know, it's an interesting barometer of the progress of mankind over the last century or so. That despite the fact that we had the technology 50 years ago to begin work on an artificial womb and artificial womb lining, we had that technology. The research could have started 50 years ago, but instead, mankind chose to develop the birth control pill. And you were one with the cause. I'm your host, Doug McBurn, joined in studio, as always, by my extremely attractive, audio engineer. Thank you for that musical interlude. We certainly appreciate it. Wanna go now to the Netherlands, which is Holland, the home of the Dutch, wherever all that comes from. An international advocacy group. And by the way, this story is from the Washington Post, which is populated by graduates of the various urinalism schools all over the nation. And I just want you to pay attention to the language here, because the language in this article is very manipulative of the stupid. And there are a lot of stupid people. Trust me. I've been out there. I know what it's like. There's lots of them. So the Washington Post is reporting on an international advocacy group. And they plan to help women. Isn't that nice? In the very first sentence. They plan to help women to use the abortion pill at home, offering online advice and counseling on how to use medications that are approved by the Food and Drug Administration to induce abortion at home. The international advocacy group is called Women Help Women, and it's headquartered in the Netherlands. Yes, and they've launched a website. It's designed, it's targeted specifically at women who may have illegally obtained medications that could induce abortion at home if they were taken in the right order. And the women just had some good advice from advocates who want to help women. Women help women. Yeah. And so it's in the Netherlands. Now, this reminds me of a story I did back in the, gosh, the very first show, maybe the very first show ever. Isn't the Netherlands the same place that abortion ship came from? Do you remember the abortion ship? It was a ship that went from port to port in nations where abortion is illegal or restricted. And they would invite women onto the ship. They would sail the ship out into international waters, and they would perform surgical abortions on them. This was, of course, back before the abortion pill. I remember calling for a military strike to sink that ship. Wasn't it the Netherlands? Let me see here. I've got the access. Here it is. Yes. It was called Women on Waves. This is Women Help Women. I wonder if this is the same pile of post-abortive, clipped-haired, clenched-jawed Dutch women. Anyway, yes, yes, you remember the Women on Waves. Let's see if they've done anything recently here. Let's see. Last reported activity of the Women on Waves abortion ship was February 2017. Well, they're still at it. The ship docked in Puerto Quetzal on the Pacific coast of Guatemala for a planned 5-day visit. But on the 23rd, their press conference was canceled and a blockade was imposed by Guatemalan army troops. Yes, all right. Preventing activists from disembarking and preventing visitors from boarding the abortion ship. Nobody was able to get abortion down at Puerto Quetzal in Guatemala. So at least someone took my advice, not an artillery barrage like I had called for, but at least the military there in Guatemala prevented the Women on Waves ship. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that story in, almost 20 years, but there you have it. But now let's get back to the Washington Post and their extremely manipulative reportage on the basically a website to help women take medications that could make them sick, could kill them, but could also certainly induce an abortion. This website is likely to add fuel to the debate about abortion, says the Washington Post, particularly abortions that are done using medication. Medication, FDA-approved medication. The abortion pill, says the Washington Post, was approved by the FDA, and it's actually two drugs, mifepristone and misoprostol, and these drugs halt the development of a pregnancy and induce miscarriage. It's a medication. It halts the development of a pregnancy, says the Washington Post. That's extremely manipulative of the stupid, because it's not a pregnancy that's halted. It is the life of a human person. But I think if you're listening to this show, you already know that, of course. So, but you could tell your friends, I suppose. The Washington Post goes on to report abortion foes have sought further restrictions on the medications in the name of safety. Those foes. A couple paragraphs down, the Post reports, many advocates say they support projects like Women Help Women. Advocates, those are the good guys. Those foes, those are the bad guys. Very manipulative language from the Post. When you assume that the Post is read by your typical publicly educated moron, the article is obviously slanted and biased against all that is right and good and true in the universe, but we would expect nothing less from the Washington Post. Speaking of needing an artillery barrage. Figurative, though. Figurative only, yes. Now, let's get to some better news. Hats off to Arkansas and their governor, Asa Hutchinson, for proving me wrong. I said 2 weeks ago I predicted that there wouldn't be an execution in Arkansas for 3 months. Well, they just executed their fourth inmate in 8 days. So I was wrong, and I'm happy to be wrong. Yes, according to CNN, Arkansas executed its fourth inmate in 8 days. Kenneth Williams was convicted of capital murder, and he was put to death on Thursday. Now, there's been some hullabaloo around the execution because his lawyer, after the execution, Kenneth Williams' lawyer asked the state of Arkansas to investigate why his client coughed and convulsed on a death chamber gurney. He says the lethal injection drugs may have been the cause. This is basically torturing a man to death. I want a hearing. He demands a hearing. Witnesses said that Kenneth Williams jerked and gasped for air for about 30 seconds before finally succumbing to the midazolam and other drugs that were... All right. So he coughed and he spittled and he convulsed for about 30 seconds. So let's talk about these 11... How many are there now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... six. Oh, there's only 8 left because 3 of the executions have been put on permanent. Well, not permanent, but they've been delayed. Okay. Eventually, all these guys will get the death penalty, but the executions have been delayed. One thing you haven't heard much in the reporting of Arkansas's horrifying effort to execute all these fine, upstanding Americans is the crimes that these people committed. So we're going to report on it here, and I'm going to put a link up on the summary of the show so that you can see for yourself. Don William Davis is the first one of the 8 who's on death row. He's convicted of capital murder in 1992 for the death of Jane Daniel. Who is this? This is from CNN. So again, the urinalism schools teach the reporters to never assign blame in any way to anyone. That's because the professors at the urinalism schools are guilty of some of the worst crimes in the history of humanity. And so the last thing they want to do is for anyone to assign blame to anyone for anything ever. And so you end up with lines like this. Don William Davis was convicted of capital murder in 1992 for the death of Jane Daniel. It was actually for the murder of Jane Daniel, but I don't want to put too fine a point on it. On the evening of October 12th, 1990, Davis burgled the home of Jane Daniel. Her husband returned later that night, found his wife shot to death in a storeroom. He shot an innocent woman to death while robbing her house. Next on the list to be executed, Stacy Eugene Johnson, convicted capital murder 1994 for the death of Carol Heath. She was beaten, strangled, and stabbed in the kitchen of her apartment, April 2, 1993. Number 3 on the list, Jack Harold Jones, convicted of rape and capital murder, 1996, for the murder of Mary Phillips. June 6, 1995, Phillips was at an accounting office with her daughter, Lacey, 11 years old. Jones robbed them at gunpoint and killed Mary Phillips in front of her 11-year-old daughter after raping her. He violently beat 11-year-old Lacey and left her for dead. She regained consciousness as police photographers who thought she was dead were taking pictures of the crime scene. That's Jack Harold Jones. Number four, Lenda Lee, convicted of capital murder in 1995 in the murder of Deborah Reese, February 9, 1993. Reese was found dead in her home. She had been strangled and beaten to death with a tire thumper, a small wooden bat that her husband had given her for protection. Lee has been executed. He was executed late Thursday night. Number five, Jason McGee, convicted capital murder 1997 in the death of 15-year-old John Melbourne. On August 19th, 1996, McGee sent Melbourne to buy shoes with a stolen check. Melbourne got caught, told the police that there were more stolen checks and property at Jason McGee's home. McGee and his friends tricked Melbourne into coming back into the house where they beat him to death. Jason McGee on death row. Number six, Bruce Earl Ward, convicted in 1990, capital murder for the murder of Rebecca Doss. April 11, 1989, her body was found in the men's restroom at the convenience store where she worked. She had been murdered during a robbery by Bruce Earl Ward. Number seven, Kenneth Williams. Kenneth D. Williams, convicted of capital murder 2000 for the murder of Cecil Boren. He was originally given a life sentence without parole for the killing of a cheerleader named Dominique Hurd in 1998. He escaped from prison in 99 and killed Cecil Boren, and he was captured after causing a traffic accident that killed another man. And finally, he sits on death row. How many years later is this? 17 years later. Finally, Marcel Wayne Williams, convicted of capital murder 1997 for the death of Stacy Erickson. November 20, 1994, Williams forced Erickson into her own car at gunpoint, made her withdraw money from several ATMs before he murdered her. And her body was found about 2 weeks later. Marcel Wayne Williams, convicted of capital murder. So these are the eight. And this is just a thumbnail sketch of their crimes. And as I read these crimes, I read the details of these crimes, I want to kill these men myself with my bare hands. And I'm here to tell you right now, if you're a red-blooded American man and you hear this story, you hear these eight stories, and you do not want to kill these men with your own hands, then you are not a man in full. You are less than a man. And if you think that mercy should be extended to any one of these bastards, you are less than a man and you are not qualified to judge. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and this is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back. We'll go from the madness of the justice system and their tolerance for convicted capital murderers. Well, I guess the policy of tolerance has come to an end, at least for a few of these guys in Arizona. Now, did I say Arizona? I meant Arkansas. But Arizona, you're welcome to do the same. Please give us some hope that there's justice somewhere. But let's go. Let's talk about opioid overdoses, because that's been all in the news lately. I've got a couple stories from a couple different angles. Up in Canada, our fine neighbor to the north, which is practically America. Canada is practically America, just with little softer edges, you know, and it's a little colder up there, right? Most of the population gets sunburned a lot more easily. That's, but it's practically America. I grew up outside of Buffalo, New York, and we used to spend Canadian change, quarters and dimes. The Canadian quarters, if I'm not mistaken, they worked in the American soda pop machines up there in the suburban Buffalo area, if there is such a thing as suburban Buffalo. I know that there is, but that's where I grew up, in rural reaches far outside of Buffalo. But let's go to our fine neighbor in the north. The according to globalnews.ca, a Canadian news source website, the British Columbia opioid crisis, let me stop right there for those of you who matriculated in the government schools. British Columbia is not in Britain, nor is it in Columbia. No, it's on the western, it's the westernmost province of the nation of Canada. And if you're not sure where Canada is, well, look on a map, Google it up. Globalnews.ca reports that the BC opioid crisis has reached a new level, with authorities confirming that last Wednesday was the worst day on record for opioid overdoses in the province of British Columbia. Yes, April 26th. This past Wednesday was this month's Welfare Wednesday in British Columbia. They call it Welfare Wednesday. Yeah. And they have one every month. On Welfare Wednesday, this past week, British Columbia had more overdose calls in a single day than ever recorded in the history of civilization anywhere. Well, at least in British Columbia. 130 overdose calls. Yes. And by the way, Welfare Wednesday is the day each month in the wonderful utopian socialist province of British Columbia when the social assistance checks go out. That's when the welfare checks arrive. And it just so happens that on the day when the welfare was doled out, well, that was the biggest day in the history of Canada for opioid overdoses. Yes, yes, 62 in Vancouver alone. Yes. So there you have it. The government tolerating the idea that people should be allowed to destroy themselves with opium and opioid drugs. And so the government doesn't execute the drug dealers. So the drug dealers, they don't execute the doctors who write these prescriptions. Right? They tolerate the whole thing and they call it a disease. And before long, you've got 130 overdoses in one day. Right when the welfare checks go out. How many people on opium are on welfare? I'm talking the street addicts, right? Injecting like behind the dumpster. How many of them are on welfare? I have an answer for you. All of them. Yes, and I know opium is more than just a problem with the needles in the dumpster. I know. There's the pills and the prescriptions. Well, I told you, I have an idea for all that too. If you're a doc and you're writing bogus prescriptions to addicts, you should be arrested, put on trial, and if you're convicted, and if anyone has died as a result of what you've done, well, you should be put to death. And then how many doctors would write those prescriptions? I have an answer for you. None. It would stop immediately overnight. One execution is all it would take. They put it on the national news, right? Let everybody know, if you write these prescriptions, doc, and somebody dies, we're going to put you to death. And we're not just going to revoke your license. In fact, we'll leave your license in state right up until we put you to death. Maybe you can give us some advice on how to mix the drugs and how to clean the needle before we put it in your arm. You could help us right through the hole. But that would end the opium crisis, at least amongst the middle class. I think it would help. I guess I shouldn't say it would end it. But it would certainly put a crimp in it, that's for sure. You'd probably have massive amounts of people showing up at rehab clinics and methadone clinics because all of a sudden they wouldn't be able to get their prescriptions. If you're caught selling opioids online and we can find out that you killed somebody, if we can prove that in court, we're going to put you to death. How many websites would deal opium online? None. They would all go away immediately. All right. And then we could try to help the poor addicts. I'm for helping the addicts, okay? I'm all for that. That's fine. But not in Las Vegas. Here's how they intend to help the addicts. In Las Vegas, according to the LA Times, vending machines dispensing clean needles are being set up in an effort to what? In an effort to combat the spread of Hep C, Hep B, HIV, and possibly leading some drug users into treatment. Really? a vending machine with needles. How exactly does that lead an addict to anything but a vending machine full of needles? Well, I guess they have a flyer. Maybe there's a phone number on the front of the vending machine. They taped it over the old Coca-Cola logo. It says, hey, call here if you need help, but put a quarter here if you want to shoot up. You know, what's an addict to do? This isn't the first time, by the way. Let me get to this. This is interesting. How does the junkie get his needles at the vending machine? Because you can't have a vending machine with needles where you just put a quarter in. For crying out loud, you'll have 8-year-olds going up thinking they're getting a candy bar. So what happens is the junkie registers with the state and obtains an 8-digit code. And this code ensures confidentiality while allowing the government to track their use of heroin. Oddly enough. When they put in their 8-digit code, the vending machine dispenses a kit containing sterile syringes and needles, along with a sharps container for used needles that can be disposed of safely right there at the machine. Yeah, and then there's a phone number on there for addiction counseling as well. Let's see, needle and syringe possession, by the way, was actually illegal in Nevada up until 2013, but no longer. The legislature repealed that law in order to lead junkies into treatment. So, let's see. Supporters of the vending machines say that the machines help remove some of the stigma faced by users who felt uncomfortable during transactions with pharmacists, because some pharmacists would ask questions as to why the syringe and the needles were needed by the guy who looks so much like a junkie and so not like somebody with diabetes. That just made them uncomfortable. You know what? For a junkie to think about rehabilitation, they need to be made to feel extremely uncomfortable. That's what has to happen. Because if you keep the junkie feeling comfortable, he'll feel comfortable right up until he injects that new elephant tranquilizer. Carfentanil. Have you heard of this? Carfentanil. It's so strong it'll knock out a car. It's carfentanil. It's used to tranquilize elephants. And people are, it's finding its way onto the street. And people who think they are just doing fentanyl are actually doing carfentanil. And then they assume the position of someone who's been struck by a car. Yes. And so there you have it. Las Vegas trying to help the junkies into treatment there. All right, let's move from the junkies to the queers. We've got Harvey Weinstein up in New York. Do you guys know Harvey Weinstein? I don't know that I've ever seen a movie that Harvey Weinstein produced. I was going to go through the list here, but then I realized I don't care. I know Harvey Weinstein makes R-rated pornographic filth, right? That's what I know about Harvey Weinstein. Well, he's upset that the Motion Picture Association of America, this is according to the Associated Press, they say Harvey's upset that his movie's been assigned an R rating by the MPAA. It's a story of a transgender teenager, and Harvey's upset that it's been rated R. He says, it shouldn't be rated R because the movie has something of social importance to say. I think it's important that we stand up. I try to fight for good, says Harvey Weinstein. Let that sink in for a minute. Harvey Weinstein says, I try to fight for good. At which point someone said, well, Harvey, you're not doing a very good job. In fact, you're totally dark, black, evil is what you are. So you're definitely off course if you think you've been fighting for good. And now you've released a movie glorifying a transgendered, mentally deranged teenager, and you're upset that they rated it R because it's full of perverted sex and all kinds of disgusting themes. He's upset because he says there's no nudity in there. And he thought maybe it was only nudity that would get him in trouble. Not encouraging mental illness. He says there's no graphic violence, no drug use or nudity. It merely portrays a modern family with a transgendered person. How could you give me an R rating? And so the movie is called, well, I don't care what it's called, and I'm not going to give him any publicity here. And finally, from the pile of queers, as we pull back the pile on the queering of America in Indianapolis, this was sent to me by a listener. Alan Belmont is North Central High School's first transgendered prom king, and she is hoping her story helps others. North Central High School, by the way, Indianapolis, Indiana, right there in the buckle of the Bible Belt, you got a 17-year-old mentally deranged junior who has been elected prom king by his equally mentally deficient classmates. And the North Central High School, by the way, this reason number 1,110 to get or keep your children out of the government schools, they may end up a transgendered prom king. That's what, yes. Now, the principal says, let's see, North Principal Evan Brannigan says, this community takes pride in its diversity and its willingness to stand behind one another. I'll just leave that lie. Whenever I hear that, yeah, you can turn it off. Off. You don't have to drag that out. Whenever I hear that, I remember, see, where I grew up outside of Odessa, Texas, small town, there was only one rock and roll station, and it wasn't really a rock and roll station, it was a pop station. Parts of the day they would play rock and roll. And what that song reminds me of is getting into my 1972 Oldsmobile Delta 88 in the morning and firing up the engine, turning the FM dial to the one and only station that might play some rock and roll, and then that song would be on. And you would have to switch it over to the weather for the next 3 minutes or so while you drove. And then you'd cruise back and forth in front of the high school parking lot, wishing that that station would play something good. Because the car's tape deck didn't work. And we only had the radio. And Tears for Fears would ruin the morning. And other musicians from that genre. With that voice. The prototypical voice in that category, of course, belonging to the lead singer from... come on, help me out. They're dark black, the black finger, the Cure, yes. The black fingernails, the black eyeliner, the black hair, the black soul, all of that. Now, just to clarify on that last story, the prom king elected in the Indianapolis High School there at North Central, that was actually a girl, just so you know, because it can be kind of confusing. You start unraveling and peeling back the pile, and it starts getting confusing as to who's who anymore. Well, it wouldn't have made the news if the queen had been a girl. And so the prom...
Is it king?
I'm sorry, if the king had been a boy is what I... See, I'm confused. I can't even hardly... Now, one thing I'm not confused about is North Korea. I'm not confused about North Korea. Listen to this story that you have not heard. I've not heard a peep about this. This is from Yonhap News. This is the South Korean version of the New York Times or the Associated Press. A former Korean-American professor has been arrested in North Korea, becoming the third U.S. citizen detained there. Now, did any of us know that there were two Americans in prison there? I didn't know that. This is the first I've heard about it. This fellow is a U.S. citizen. He's a former professor at the Yanbian University. He's in his late 50s. He's been engaged in aid and relief programs to North Korea, which is very risky business, and now he ends up in prison. He reportedly was in North Korea for about a month working on relief activities. The reason for his arrest is not clear, says Yon Hap, meaning that the journalism schools have obviously gotten to the Yon Hap news agency, too. The reason for his arrest is perfectly clear. The dictator in North Korea is a madman hell-bent on war. That's the problem. That's the reason. There's no other reason. Do you think this aid worker was actively spying on North Korea in order to coordinate attack from the South and America? Is that possible? Well, it's not possible. The guy's an aid worker trying to save people from starving to death in North Korea. He's been arrested, and Yon Hap says, well, the reason is not clear. We don't know why. Of course you know why. It's because of the goofball, the fat kid with the bad haircut. That's the problem. They should say the reason for his arrest is that Kim Jong-un is a madman. That would be good journalism. Let's see here. Two other U.S. citizens, Otto Warmbier, a college student, and a Korean-American pastor, Kim Dong-chul, are also detained. They've been sentenced to long prison terms for what the dictator calls subversive acts. Since 2009, according to Yon Hap, about 10 U.S. citizens have been detained in North Korea. Pyongyang often uses the detentions as bargaining chips in negotiating with Washington, and they've been doing that since I can remember. I think on the same show when I called for the artillery barrage on the abortion ship from the Netherlands, I think I was calling for a preemptive strike against North Korea. That's almost 20 years ago. So I've always known where I stood on North Korea. And the one I will give Donald Trump credit for not tolerating at least this level of an insane maniac madman any longer. And I just hope that once Mr. Dung is removed and the crisis is averted, which I believe it will be, that Donald Trump will take a lesson that you cannot tolerate those who advocate the wholesale destruction and murder of innocent people. They cannot be tolerated in civilized society. And there's plenty of them amongst us right here in America. And there are plenty of them on death row, as a matter of fact. And so anyway, maybe Donald Trump will make some on-the-job training. He'll find his moral compass. We can always hope, right? Now, from the bad religion file, in the Gaza Strip, they've run out of electricity. The reason, the Hamas-controlled energy authority in Gaza said it no longer has the funds to buy more diesel fuel for their diesel-fired generators because they're not getting any more welfare money from Qatar and Turkey. The Hamas-run health ministry said Gaza residents' lives are in danger due to rolling power cuts. What Hamas should have said is that Gaza residents' lives are in danger due to the fact that Hamas is in charge. The place is run by a bunch of terrorists. A criminal gang runs Gaza, is what's happened here. And Qatar and Turkey have probably become offended enough by the maniacal behavior of Hamas that they're just not giving them any more money. And of course, is Hamas headquarters? Are they experiencing rolling blackouts? No. No, it's the poor people in the in what's called a refugee camp. It's been called a refugee camp for almost 70 years now. It's pretty weird. But let's move on. From the Middle East, where it's obviously dangerous, it's scary. People are dying every day in the Middle East. It's a terrifying place to live. The Gaza Strip, got to be like living in a prison where the prisoners run the facility. Everything's madness and danger. You could be killed at any moment. Well, meanwhile, NBC Chicago reports that Justin Lampkins is a 25-year-old Marine.
He was in a truck with his friends in line at a McDonald's drive-thru early last Saturday morning at about 1 o'clock in the morning. A horn was sounded and an altercation ensued. The details are not exactly clear on who sounded their horn, who said what, who threw the first punch. Nobody knows exactly. But at the end, 22-year-old Evan Schaefer shot the young Marine to death. Shot him in the chest and killed him. At a McDonald's drive-thru in Chicago. Not in Gaza, not in Syria, not in Afghanistan, not in Iraq. It wasn't an IED, an improvised explosive device, that killed this young Marine. No, it was just your average product of the government schools. Your average public school graduate or dropout, we don't know. But the young Marine is dead at a drive-thru in McDonald's in Hollywood. Now, I wasn't with you last week, and I didn't have an opportunity to address the Aaron Hernandez suicide. The day it happened, my extremely attractive audio engineer and I, we read that Mr. Hernandez had scrawled John 3:16 across his forehead and then hung himself with his bedsheet in his prison cell. And we both entertained the idea, and his Bible was open to John 3:16. We entertained the idea that perhaps Aaron Hernandez, having just been acquitted of a double murder that he knew darn well he committed, and looking forward to life in prison for another murder that he knows darn well he committed, that maybe he had found repentance. He had read the Bible. He thought about his life. He felt so horrible that he decided to kill himself. I know some people say suicide is the unforgivable sin. I disagree. If you're a lowlife as low as Aaron Hernandez, I could understand you wanting to kill yourself. Even if you came to repentance and said, God, I'm sorry, you could still feel so bad that you just want to kill yourself. I could understand that. I don't think it's unforgivable. So we talked about the fact that no matter how bad Aaron Hernandez is, he could be saved. He could repent. It's possible, right? Nothing is too hard for the living God. His arm is not so short that he cannot save. He could forgive even Aaron Hernandez, even if he killed himself. So there was, we talked about it. Well, a few days later, three handwritten notes were discovered in Aaron Hernandez's cell. One was to his fiancée, one was to his daughter, and the third note was, have you heard this story yet? Oh, you haven't heard this. Oh. The third letter was addressed to his homosexual jailhouse lover. And at that point, I thought, well, maybe Aaron didn't repent. It's pretty disgusting, huh?
Well, maybe
really sorry I had to even bring this up.
Maybe he read the Bible right before he killed.
Well, maybe. But I think it's, I kind of have a bad feeling that Aaron didn't ever come around. And I think the whole John 3:16 on his forehead was, I just don't know. I just know that he played football for 3 years with Tim Tebow during the time when Tebow went through the controversy of John 3:16 on his.
So that's the only verse he knew.
Yeah, maybe that's the, at least Tim Tebow introduced. That's probably the only verse he had ever been familiar with, thanks to Tim Tebow.
Yeah.
All right. So there you have it. All right, so we're almost out of time. Do I have anything else that... I don't want to do these stories about the Facebook suicides and the murders on Facebook. It's horrifying that here we have a technology that can allow people to communicate, and it's a great resource. It's a vast social potential for good is Facebook. And you've got people killing other people and killing themselves, and I just don't want to do those stories. I just don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about Maine grandmothers for reproductive rights. Have you heard of this? Grandmothers for reproductive rights.
We call ourselves GRRR. G-R-R. GRRR.
Read it. What is it?
Bunch of post-abortive grannies. They started a group called GRRR. And they say, what we're doing is not for us at this point. It's for our daughters, our sons, our grandsons, and our granddaughters. At least the ones we don't kill is what we're saying. GRRR.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't want to talk about them. Let's end with this. Space. Have you seen the bumper sticker, Earth First? We'll mine the other planets later. Have you seen that one? I always got a chuckle out of that bumper sticker. Well, prospecting satellites can now be built for about the same amount it costs to build a modern mining operation on Earth. While space mining is still a long way from commercial viability, it does have potential. Companies are expected to launch satellites searching for rare gases and metals in asteroids within 5 years, with actual mining happening within perhaps 8 years. Yeah. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, they are developing space programs and investing in nascent private space commodity initiatives. This is according to Todd James, an energy consultant. And he says Middle East investment in space is growing as Middle East countries work to shift from an oil-based to a knowledge-based economy. And they talk about platinum mining. A single asteroid, they say, may contain 175 times more platinum than on the entire Earth mined in a year. Yeah, that's pretty cool. This much platinum could be worth $25 to $50 billion. Uh-huh. Platinum. Platinum's on asteroids. Interesting. Where else is platinum commonly? Oh, platinum is on Earth. That's right. Platinum is on Earth. I get it. I won't go any further with that. I'll just leave that one hang out there. You guys figure it out. All scientists work for Walt Brown. If you have not read In the Beginning, go to creationscience.com. Check it out. It's really cool. You can find out where asteroids came from and why they have platinum. How about that? In the meantime, this is the Weekly Worldview. Thank you for listening. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com and AmericanRightToLife.com. And should the Lord tarry, we will return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.